This is the Talk of Gasoline Alley on WIBC. We've got callers hanging on, so let's go straight to the phones. And we got Jay from St. Paul, Minnesota. Good evening, Jay.
Hey again, Donald. Great to be back again. The other day, you before I asked my real question, you were talking about the borrowed spring story. They borrowed a car off a Ford.
It took a spring off of a Ford Model T. Yeah,
right.
That was in 1930. Uh-huh.
And then you made a little aside there about people sometimes bringing the bringing a little bit of race driver home with them.
Oh,
and making turns.
Yeah.
And I don't know if any IRL marketing guys are listening, but I thought a perfect commercial for them would be a guy working late at night, and he goes out to the parking ramp, and as he's going down the ramp, he sort of swings out to the right a little bit and then cuts in to the left. Anyway, just a little aside.
Oh, okay. Well, what I was referring to the other night, and I've done this at talks a few times, and it always gets a laugh, the fact that if you drive 465 and there's not much traffic around, if you're going anti-clockwise, so they're all left-hand turns, what you can do is when you come up to a turn, you can just gradually move over to cut the apex of the quote turn end quote, and that usually gets a laugh. That's what we were referring to.
Right. Anyway, I was wondering if you could talk about the history of the silver hats.
Silver hats?
The silver hats worn by the track officials.
You mean the pith helmets?
Yeah.
And they used to wear just after the war, and then through the 50s, and
yeah.
Okay. Yeah, those. Those are called pith helmets, and it was the safety patrol is what they called them. From the time the track opened up until 1947, all of the events were policed by the Indiana National Guard. And after Tony Holman purchased the track and a number of the old guard for a pun either intended or not intended there. They decided, you know what, we could do this ourselves. So we think it's in 1948 is when the safety patrol was formed with many of the same people and a lot of police and ex-police. And somebody had a bunch of these pith helmets, P-I-T-H, and it's the kind that you would wear on safari. And for a number of years, that was the headgear. The outfits were blue wool, which were extremely hot. They had to wear a light blue tie. Why you would have the top button up and a tie on, I have no idea. They were harder than blazers. If it rained, then the wool soaked up the water and your shirt weighed 30 pounds. And nobody liked those outfits. But the pith helmets were part of it. And they didn't get replaced until it was about probably 1970 or 71 is when they went over to the yellow shirts, short sleeves, and the baseball caps. Or actually, they started with a thing called bump. I think they were called them bump helmets. It was like a batting helmet that they had for a couple of years. They were plastic, golden colored, and they would have their name on a piece of tape across the front of the thing. But anyway, it was the pith helmets went from 48 until about 70, 71, and the heads of department were gold. And the rank and file, which numbered many hundreds on race day and qualifying days, were silver. And they eventually ran out of them because the guards would take them home for souvenirs. But anyway, that was it. Those were gone by 72, 73. I don't think they were around anymore. Okay, Jay?
Great, super, thanks.
All right, we thank you very much indeed for the call. Alex, Paul, Ellen, Jay, Rick, hang on. We go to check in with Steve Simpson.
All right, guys, thanks.
You are listening to the Talk of Gasoline Alley on WIBC. We're here every night through, actually not the night before the race, but two nights before the race, from 6 until 7, entertaining your questions about the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and the history of the 500-mile race and the participants. We've got Alex on the phone, so Alex, you're up.
Hello, Donald. I was wondering if you'd talk a little bit about Preston Tucker and his ties to the Speedway, and I'm especially interested in what his relationship was with Ted Horn.
Well, I don't know that he had a relationship with Ted Horn other than the fact, well, I bet, let me back up. Preston Tucker was here with the Ford family in 32 or 33, and Studebaker, this is after the specifications had changed. They were in what was unkindly referred to as the junk era. That's a whole other story. But the thing is that there had been a change in specifications in order to encourage the manufacturers to come back and participate. Well, hardly any of them met the challenge, and so what you had was detuned racing cars before the specs had changed, plus you had some backyard specials. But one company that did answer the call was Studebaker, and they were here in 32 and 33 with a five-car team, and the Ford family came down. It was Henry Ford, Edsel Ford, his son, and then Henry Ford II, who was about 15, and Benson Ford, who was about probably 13 or 12, and then the youngest one, William Clay Ford, was too young to come. Anyway, Preston Tucker was with them. And so Preston Tucker, or rather Edsel Ford, was always trying to make his father happy, which he could never do. And one of the things was that Preston Tucker talked Edsel into, if Studebaker's here with a five-car team, why don't we do a 10-car team? So they hired Harry Miller, who was sort of on the downside of his career, arguably, and they built a 10-car team, beautiful chassis containing the Ford V8 flathead passenger car engine, and they used stock wheels and a stock steering wheel and everything like that. Henry Ford was not in favor of it. They pushed ahead, and it was less than successful. We're not sure that the 10th car was ever completed, but 9 made qualifying attempts. 4 made it, and there was a design flaw where the steering box was located right next to the head. And Peter DiPaolo and Cliff Brazier, who were on the original team, said the box is going to seize up when it gets hot. You won't be able to steer the car. And indeed, that was the reason that the four cars in the race all had to drop out. One of the drivers was Ted Horn. So that would be the only connection that I would know of. Preston Tucker, what I didn't mention, was the team manager. But he lived in Indianapolis for a while. And he was the sales manager for a Packard dealership, which was on North Meridian. Peyton Wells was there in recent years. It would be probably about 15th and Meridian. And so he was here for about 2 years. He lived at the Athletic Club and then went on to other things. In fact, we better make a two-parter out of this because there is a part two to Preston Tucker's involvement at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. So, as usual, we've run out of time again. So, Paul, Ellen, Jay, and Rick, you hang on. 239-1070 is the number to call with your questions about the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and we will be back in a few minutes. We are back with the talk of Gasoline Alley, and before we had that the news break, we were talking about Preston Tucker, who really was a person. That the film was based on his life with Beau Bridges, I believe. I never did see the film, but anyway, Preston Tucker was lived in Indianapolis. Jeff Bridges. Okay. He lived in Beau Bridges was Connie Coletta, I think. I don't know. Anyway, he lived here for probably about 2 years when he was the sales manager at that Packard dealership. It changed names. I think it might have been Packard of Indianapolis or something like that. And then there was another double-barreled name. But so he was here probably 36 and 37. And that was after he'd been the team manager for the Ford V8 Miller team in 1935. Anyway, the next time that he appeared was after the war when the Tucker automobile was produced in Chicago, and not very many of them, but there were a number of racing people that were connected with it. And a vice president of Tucker was Ralph Hepburn. Many-time competitor in the 500, and there were a number of other people that had been drivers or almost drivers and mechanics who were Tucker employees, and he sponsored a car in 46 and 47. There was a rear-engine car which had been a Miller There were actually three of them. They were rear-engine Millers that Harry Miller designed after the Ford V8 Miller team of 1935. So now we're talking 38, 39. Anyway, after the war, they had gone into private hands, and Preston Tucker, because the Tucker was going to be rear-engined, they hit upon the idea of calling... actually, the 1946 car that George Barringer drove was called the Tucker Torpedo Special. And on the what would now be the area where the side pod is, except there weren't side pods in those days, they actually had an outline painted off the car. And then in 1947, it was there were three cars called the Preston Tucker Partners Special. One of them was the rear-engine car that Al Miller drove, and then there were two front-engine cars that were owned by Joe Lenke, the infamous Joe Lenke, who was a car owner, who was associated with the Preston Tucker automobile in Chicago for just the very short time that it lasted. In 1948, there was one car entered it was the rear-engine car again, and they called it the Preston Tucker Rear-Engine Special. And it was a little confusing because some people have connected that with Preston Tucker in that it was a Tucker car. It was not. It was a pre-existing car that was sponsored by Preston Tucker. Anyway, that was the last appearance here. But just to back up, they did actually test the Tuckers on the track, and there was an incident, and I never did see the film, but apparently there's an incident at one point where the car rolls, a Tucker rolls, and the windshield pops out. That actually happened. A mechanic by the name of Eddie Offutt, O-F-F-U-T, who was a longtime Harry Miller mechanic, and was here many times as a chief mechanic and crew member on those rear-engine cars, as a matter of fact. He was one of the test drivers for the Tucker automobile, and I do not know if this was the spring or the fall or the winter, but far apart from race time, there were no leaves on the trees. It was Eddie Offutt, actually, I think in turn three. George Moore, the late George Moore, the star, told me about this, that he actually rolled the car and the windshield popped out. So in the film, it doesn't take place at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, but in reality, that's where it was. Anyway, we thank you very much indeed for the call, and let's quickly go to Paul in Racine. And Paul, at least we'll get your question in before we have to do some business. Good evening.
Good evening, Donald. How are you today?
Fine, thank you.
You're missing Dave.
He's off tonight.
He what?
I say Dave is off tonight.
Oh, okay.
So we're doing a solo.
Yeah, you're doing a good job. Can you talk about Shim Malone, please?
Yeah. He was a starter. He was from the West Coast and flagged for many years in CRA, some sports cars, but mostly short track. And he used to do West Coast USAC races. I mean, when I first went to USAC, I remember that he would do like Agajanian tracks, and then also just West Coast tracks. He wanted to get involved back here. I think he was sort of like an assistant starter at the Speedway for a few years, although quite honestly, most of those were honorary positions. Normally there would be just the flagman, and then the assistant starters would just sort of try to be of help by handing the flag to the starter and so on and so forth. Anyway, it was his ambition to be the chief starter at the 500, and he never got that realized, but he was the... he was the chief starter for the championship division for a number of years. He did move back here, became part of the USAC family, if you like, and he was the midget supervisor for several years. He also had an involvement at the track in he helped conduct the rookie tests, and he was one. Mid 70s, probably. I'm just going to think about probably 74, 75, and 76, after Tom Binfer became the chief steward, and Shim was very close with Dick King of USAC, and so by 76, I would say it was, that he was helping conduct the rookie test. In April 24th of 1978, he was one, or the night of the 23rd, 24th, he was one of eight USAC officials that went down on a private plane, or chartered plane, that was coming back from Trenton just about a week before the Speedway was going to open. And he was, some people used to needle him because he would wear like a dinner jacket. I mean, he was just trying to class the thing up. I mean, he admired Pat Vidan and with the white jacket and everything, and he would go a step further and sometimes would flag in like two-tone shoes, black and white two-tone shoes, and then also, I mean, he would wear a dinner jacket that you would expect, you know, Wayne Newton to be wearing or Sammy Davis Jr. or somebody like that on a Las Vegas act, but he was just trying to class the thing up. Okay, Paul, if you had a follow-up, we're going to have to take it after the break here. Did you have more?
Well, just briefly, was Shim his real name, number one? And then number two, did he flag all the other IndyCar races other than Indianapolis?
Yes, he did. He did the whole championship circuit, and that was not his name. He does have a son named Critter Malone, and then Critter isn't his name. Critter's a nickname, but Critter Malone drove USAC midgets. In fact, I think he is no longer racing, but he did for quite a few years, and also he was a crew member on many, many teams. Anyway, Paul, we're kind of backed up a little bit. Ellen, Jay, Rick, hang on. We'll be back with the talk of Gasoline Alley on WIBC, and the callers are stacked up, so let's go to Ellen. Good evening.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm doing well. I've got a question tonight.
Okay.
My husband and I saw on the news the other evening that some people were wearing AJ Floyd Triple Crown T-shirts. Can you please help us identify which races he won to receive a Triple Crown?
I don't know what that would refer to. There was a mythical Triple Crown several years ago when they had the Indianapolis 500, the Pocono, Pennsylvania 500, and the Ontario 500. Mm-hmm. And so there was Al Unser, actually, in 1978, won all three events, and so they gave him, I think he got like a plaque. There was no cash at all. Mm-hmm. And then there's been, then USAC has declared a Triple Crown for anybody that can win the Silver Crown, the Sprint, and the Midget titles. And the people that have done that in the same year were Tony Stewart and J.J. Yaley. I don't think a third person's done it, but I'm not sure what the AJ Foyt Triple Crown would be.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, I'll try to find out. I'll take a look at one of those T-shirts or call my friend at USAC and find out if they know.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot. And back to the phones, and Rick, go ahead. Rick, you're up.
Hi, Donald. How are you?
Fine, sir. How are you?
Great. About fell asleep here.
About what?
Kind of think of you as the Dick Clark of Speedway Radio. You sound the same year after year. It's like you're ageless.
Oh, well, thank you.
Just as sharp today as you were, I don't know how many years ago. Well, 20 at least, huh?
Well, if you saw me, you'd see there's been a difference.
The truth with all of us. I've got something, a couple things to ask, and I'll lead you into why I'm thinking about this here in a second.
All right, we're going to have to do Steve here for just a second. Hang on, we're going to do a little programming here. Yeah, all right, I'll tell you what, hold your two thoughts, because we do have to check in with Steve Simpson here, and then we'll come back, and then you can tell me what the thoughts are. So hang on, and we throw it to Steve Simpson. Back with the talk of Gasoline Alley, and during the break, Matt Hiblin told us that somebody had called in with a suggestion that the AJ Foyt Triple Crown may be a reference to the fact that he won the Indianapolis 500, the Daytona 500, and the 24 Hours of Daytona. Three big events. Maybe a bit of a stretch, but evidently that may be what they're referring to. Anyway, we had to take a break there. So, Rick, we left you dangling, and you didn't give us your thoughts, and now take it away. You have two thoughts.
Right. To get to it here, I know you're busy. I wondered who the youngest driver to ever win the 500 is.
Troy Ruttman, 1952.
How old would he have been?
22 years. Well, he was born on March the 11th of 1930, and the 500 was on May 30th, 1952.
Really?
Yes. So it's 22 years, 1 month, and 19 days, or something like that, I think. Okay.
Secondly, was there ever a driver born and raised in Indianapolis that won the 500?
Yes.
I wonder about George Robeson.
No, he was born in England. He was born in Newcastle in England, yes, and raised in Southern California. Bill Cummings is one. The other ones that I've got to kind of hesitate with just a second. Wilbur Shaw, who lived much of his life in Indianapolis, actually born in Shelbyville. Joe Dawson, who won in 1912. All the references are to the fact that he was born in Indianapolis is not true, and it's Ligoti or somewhere like that. It's not that, but it's right down in that area. But it's not up here. I'm drawing a blank on that one at the moment. L.L. Corum was born in Johnstown, which is down the road a piece. Jonesboro. Boy, I'm going to have to hit the books. But anyway, he's also credited with being born in Indianapolis, but he was not. Then Bill Cummings, and I think that's it.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what got me headed on that. I have an 18-year-old that's going to race at the Speedway in June, and he's running Formula BMW this year. And I just thought there'd probably been somebody 18, 19 years old by now that would have won it. But he's got 4 years here to get in there, doesn't he?
We last year we came within 200 yards of having a 19-year-old winner.
Oh, yeah. He's been about 2 years ahead of us in karting and some of this other racing. We've just never got a chance to get on the track with him. But we're giving it a try.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Thanks for the call. All right, let's squeeze in. Brian, I think we can take you, so go ahead.
Hi, Donald. I was just asking a question. I had a question about when did they stop using the special, like the Miller Lite special during like qualifications?
Yeah. I've been asked that several times this year, as a matter of fact, in talks and so on and so forth. It started to go away. It used to be all the cars were called specials. It started to go away when the rear engine cars came in. People started to call it the so-and-so Eagle, the so-and-so McLaren, the so-and-so Lotus, and that kind of thing. So it kind of went by the wayside when they started to come with fancy names like the Gould Charge, the Norton Spirit, and names like that, which was sort of early to mid-70s. And by the time you got to the late 70s, not very many people were using special anymore. And now, really, nobody does. The Sumar special in 2000 with Andy Hillenburg was about the last one. But anyway, that's unfortunately all the time that we have for tonight. The sponsors found out that we're here, so we're loaded up again. But that's okay. We'll be here every night and happy to take your questions about the Indianapolis 500 and its history. We want to thank Mac Heblin for being down at the station and taking your calls and then sending them out here. And as ever, Scott Johnston, who's been the on-site producer here for, 10 years? 15? Oh, my goodness. Okay, anyway, couldn't do it without you. You're a rock, and thank you for being out here every night, even when you probably could be doing something else. Anyway, that's about all the time that we have for tonight. We'll be back tomorrow night with the Talk of Gasoline Alley on WIBC.